You are now listening to the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. All right, welcome back to the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, week two here. This week, as we promised last week, we introduced the show and kind of talked about what the show is going to be all about. And so this week, we're going to discuss the meaning of both the word Protestant and the word libertarian. One of the problems that I think we run into in our society over and over and over again, and we're going to come back to this theme on the show all the time, is that people use these words and these terms, but they never actually define what these terms mean. And so when I say the word Protestant or when I say the word libertarian, there are all kinds of people that are going to come to different conclusions about what those two words mean. And so I wanted to really early in this podcast series to just kind of outline what I mean when I use the word Protestant, what I mean when I use the word libertarian, and then how I fit into those categories that I'm going to outline right now. Again, it's so important, and we're going to have several days where we talk about socialism and capitalism and justification and all kinds of very important issues from both a Protestant and a libertarian perspective. And we're always going to start with a definition of these terms. It's incredibly important. So since this is called the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, and I actually do know a little bit more about Protestantism than I do about libertarianism, I'm going to start with the meaning of the word Protestant first. Now, we obviously don't have a time, we don't have the time on the show today to go through a detailed historical analysis of 16th century Europe to analyze what all of the various Protestant reformers said by that. But what the word Protestant basically means to me, it comes from the word protest, and it's a protest against the abuses of the late medieval Catholic Church. And one of the things that most of the early people that were labeled Protestants or reformers had in common is that they believed that the Catholic Church hierarchy, whether it was the Pope, especially the Pope in the 14th century for sure, with the whole debacle at Avignon and everything that was tied in with that, a lot of Catholics looked at the Church and understood that they were failing to deliver on a lot of the promises that they had made. And there were many intellectuals throughout Europe that realized that the Church was not being what they thought the Church was supposed to be. And they saw a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of corruption in the Catholic Church, and they wanted to change that. But the problem for a lot of these early reformers was that you have to have, all right, so if the traditional hierarchies of the Catholic Church, whether it's the Pope or, you know, the teachings of the priest or whatever, if those are corrupt, then what are you going to replace them with? Like, how are you going to decide whether or not a Pope is not doing what the Pope is supposed to do, and how are you going to decide whether or not what is being taught at the church is right or wrong? You have to have another source of authority. And so the early reformers of the 14th and early 15th century, like John Wycliffe and like Jan Hus, all came to the conclusion that the Bible, the scriptures, should be the only source of authority in the church. Or if they didn't believe that it was the only source, it should at least be the primary source of authority. So if the Pope taught something or did something, or if the Catholic Church was engaged in something that could not be found or affirmed by the scriptures, then the church needed to challenge that and to change. And for a lot of these early reformers, the goal was not to try to leave the Catholic Church and start a brand new movement. The goal was to, as the word Reformation implies, reform the church from within. They did not want to leave the Catholic Church. They wanted to reform the church, to change it, to make it better. And even though a lot of these early reformers had different theological perspectives and they disagreed on all kinds of issues, the common core of the early Protestant movement is that belief that the Bible should be the only source of authority. Obviously, the most important reformer is Martin Luther, who was born in 1883 and died in 1883, who was born in 1483 and died in 1546. And Martin Luther is a German monk. I'm sure if you're listening to the Protestant Libertarian, you're familiar with Martin Luther's background, and I'm sure we'll get into that on a later date. But because of a set of circumstances in Martin Luther's life, he becomes a monk. And during his training to become a monk, he becomes a doctor. doctor in the Catholic Church, meaning that he was trained and then given the task of teaching the Bible to the people of the Catholic Church. And he's stationed in a city in Germany called Wittenberg. And so Martin Luther, as he's reading the scriptures, comes to the conclusion that there are lots of problems within the Catholic Church. Again, he's familiar with the other early reformers, and he realizes that there has to be some sort of basis to challenge the corrupt authority of the church. And at one point in Martin Luther's life, he makes a trip to Rome to see the Pope, and he realizes that Rome is decadent and corrupt, and that what he sees in Rome is completely antithetical, completely against everything that he believed he was reading in Scripture. There's a really good book that I read a few years ago by a scholar whose last name is Kaufman called A Short Life of Martin Luther, and I've read a couple of biographies on Martin Luther. This one is a really great, like 150-page bullet point kind of overview of Martin Luther's life. Fantastic. I would highly recommend it. You can get it on Amazon for a couple of dollars. But what Kaufman argues in this book is that the Catholic Church ordained, ordained's not the right word, but the Catholic Church committed Martin Luther to becoming a doctor of the church, meaning that he took an oath to defend the Catholic Church against all heresies. And so from Martin Luther's perspective, he's reading the Bible. He realizes that there are lots of things in the Bible that are not being taught by the church, and that there are a lot of practices that the church have that don't go back to the Bible. And so Martin Luther decides that he has to criticize those practices of the church. And very famously in 1517, on October 31st, he nails 95 theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg there. And that was kind of like a bulletin board in the late Middle Ages. That's where you'd post something that people want to read. And Martin Luther in particular, in the 95 theses, was challenging this idea of indulgences. It was a practice that the Catholic Church had instituted where, the standpoint of Catholic theology, when you die, you either go to hell if you're damned, to heaven if you're saved, or if you are a Catholic but you need to pay off some of your debts, then you go to purgatory to purge yourself of your sins. So the Catholic Church had come up with this idea that if you wanted to shorten your time in purgatory, or if you wanted to shorten the time of a family member in purgatory, then you could spend money on one of these papal indulgences, and according to the church, that would limit the amount of time that you or your loved one had to spend in purgatory. And Martin Luther didn't see any justification for that in the Bible at all. So he nails the 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg church, sends a copy to the Pope, and creates a firestorm throughout Europe because he's openly challenging the authority of Rome and the authority of the Catholic Church. And again, it's not Martin Luther's goal to leave the church. That was never the intention of Luther. His goal was to reform the Catholic Church from within, to try to make the Catholic Church better. That was Martin Luther's goal. But the big picture, the thing that we need to take away from the Reformation is eventually Martin Luther goes before the Diet of Worms, is how you pronounce that, or how I pronounce that since I'm from Kentucky. He's called to this Catholic Church, basically trial in 1521, called the Diet of Worms. And he stands before all these Catholic leaders, and they give him the option of either going back and recanting, saying that he doesn't agree with the things that he'd formerly taught, or he would be excommunicated, kicked out of the church. Martin Luther, very famously, probably, although there are a couple of biographers that don't know if Martin Luther actually said this, Martin Luther probably in that conference said something to the effect of, if you can prove to me that my teachings are wrong based on the scripture, then I will recant, but if you cannot, my conscience is clear, I have to follow the Bible. And so Martin Luther is excommunicated from the Catholic Church, and eventually his followers will break away from the Catholic Church and begin the Protestant movement as an independent sort of theological movement within Christianity. And again, the common denominator for Martin Luther and for the rest of the reformers is the belief that the Bible is the only source of authority. Now, this does cause lots of problems because all of the reformers, even down to this day, even in the Protestant movement today, everyone interprets the Bible differently. So we're going to have to deal with biblical interpretation in a different episode. But the main idea here is that the Bible should be the only source of authority, and that is what makes somebody a Protestant. That is the one thing that should hold all Protestants together, the idea that the Bible is it. If it's not there and we can't justify a church practice from the Bible, then we need to discard it or challenge it or critique it. That was Martin Luther's big idea. And so I, you know, used to work at a Lutheran church, and I still kind of identify as a Lutheran, but I want to clear up one issue real quick. When I talk about my Lutheran background, what I mean by that is a little bit different than what most people mean. So I think there are kind of two ways of thinking about being a Lutheran or thinking about being a Protestant in general. On the one hand, you have doctrinal or dogmatic Lutherans or Protestants, and these are people that they hold to a particular Protestant set of doctrines. So if you're a Lutheran, that means that you accept all of the teachings of Martin Luther. If you are a Calvinist, it means that you accept all of the teachings of Calvin. If you're a Wesleyan, it means that you accept the teachings of John Wesley, and that's a doctrinal or a dogmatic Protestant. So their way of interpreting or reading the Bible is going to be mediated through the founder of their particular Protestant tradition. But I have a slightly different way of looking at that. So I would consider myself to be an ideological or a presuppositional Lutheran. And what I mean by ideological or presuppositional Lutheran is that my presupposition, the foundation for my worldview, is that the Bible is the only source of authority. And so that leads me to challenge not just traditional teachings of the Catholic Church, which has obviously since the Council of Trent in the 16th century reformed in a lot of very positive ways, but that leads me to challenge even traditional doctrines within Lutheranism or whatever church I happen to be a part of. The Bible has to challenge all other sources of authority. And so when I talk about being a Protestant or when I talk about being a Lutheran, and what I mean is that I'm taking the big idea of the Protestant movement, the big idea of Martin Luther, which is that concept that the Bible should be the only source of authority and kind of the last word that we go to. That is where that is the source from which I derive my authority. So that's what I mean by Protestant. On this podcast, when I say the Protestant libertarian, what I mean is that I am a Christian who is committed to the teachings of Scripture, and that is my foundation. So that's what I mean by that term there. Libertarianism, on the other hand, there are several different ways to look at libertarianism. And again, the idea behind libertarianism is just that people should be free to make their own choices. Again, it comes from the word liberty, or liberty is at least the root word for libertarianism. It's the idea that people need to be free to make their own decisions and that we should not try to force or impose our values or our beliefs onto other people. But there are a lot of different ways of looking at libertarianism, and I want to kind of discuss what that philosophy means. So there's a writer for Reason Magazine, and if you're here for the libertarian, I'm sure the libertarian part of the show, I'm sure you've heard of or read Reason Magazine at some point in your life. And there is a lot of debate within the libertarian movement as to whether or not Reason Magazine is kind of the best example of the libertarian movement. But they do have some very good articles a lot of the times. And there was one a couple of months ago written by and I'm not sure if she's an editor or just a regular columnist named Stephanie Slade, and her article is called Must Libertarians Care About More Than the State? And it was published in the April 2022 issue of Reason Magazine. And she makes a distinction between political libertarians and comprehensive libertarians. And so I'm going to give you the definitions of those in a minute. I'm going to read a little excerpt from her article here. But essentially what she means by that is a political libertarian is a libertarian that thinks that the libertarian philosophy should only apply to politics. So from a political perspective, we should never use, kind of the levers of power in society to coerce or force somebody to do something that we don't want to do. But that might not necessarily be true if you're in a religious setting where, if someone comes to your church, you have a certain amount of authority over that person, or in family settings or things like that. So that would be a political libertarian. And that's somebody that would just wants to limit those libertarian ideas to their politics. For there's another group of libertarians called the comprehensive libertarian, and those are libertarians that are not just libertarian from a political perspective, but they're libertarian from a personal perspective as well. They kind of believe that people should be morally free to do whatever they want, and that people should be able to make their own choices no matter how self-destructive or harmful those might be. So we're going to start out with a small quote from Slade's article, and I'm going to read her definition of comprehensive libertarians and political libertarians. And she starts out making a comment on the great libertarian philosopher Murray Rothbard. And if you are new to libertarianism and you have not read any Murray Rothbard, you need to go on Amazon right now, buy yourself a copy of Anatomy of the State, maybe get a good dictionary. I know there were a couple of words in there that I had to look up, and read it. It is only about 60 pages long. It is an unbelievably powerful look at the way that the state exercises control over people in a given society. Murray Rothbard's a brilliant man, very controversial, and not all libertarians like Murray Rothbard, but I definitely happen to be someone that was influenced by him. But Murray Rothbard was definitely somebody who was more of a political libertarian. He kind of believed that libertarian principles should be confined to the political sphere. And so here's what Stephanie Slade says in her article. If libertarianism properly understood has no cultural commitments, shouldn't that open up room to parlay? Such a hope seems to have animated Murray Rothbard when he wrote in 1981 that libertarianism is strictly a political philosophy confined to what the use of violence should be in social life. As such, he added, it is not equipped to take one position or another on personal morality or virtue. So it's libertarianism that allows us to take a hard stance against any sort of state power, but then when it comes to personal morality or virtue, we can look at things from a different perspective. Stephanie Slade, who is a Catholic, goes on to say this: how convenient it would be for this Catholic libertarian, as such as anyone, if that were the end of that. But the big tent of libertarianism clearly houses many adherents whose self-understanding goes quite a bit further than Rothbard's. In fact, one useful way to divide and corral the unruly menagerie under our great circus pavilion is to ask the question Rothbard begs: is individual liberty merely the highest political principle, the thing for which government exists, or is it a philosophical North Star by which to direct all aspects of our lives? Let us call the two groups political libertarians and comprehensive libertarians. And then Stephanie Slade gives a definition of both. So comprehensive libertarians, she says this: for comprehensive libertarians, as we've seen, a good society is one in which people are maximally free to be who they want to be, pursuing the good life according to whatever that means to them. Comprehensive libertarians are reflexively opposed to both hard and soft infringements on liberty. The only limit, though it is a crucial one, is that someone's pursuit of happiness can't forcibly interfere with anyone else. And she goes on to talk about the distinction between people having sex in whatever way they want and comparing that with rape or human trafficking, that your ability to make decisions about your own sexuality should not be hindered by anybody. But obviously, if you're coercing somebody into a sexual act, that would be wrong. And that's an example of comprehensive libertarianism. Political libertarians, this is Stephanie Slade's definition here, don't have this sort of straightforward heuristic to fall back on. On any given question in the non-governmental domain, we might see liberty as one of the many competing values. It won't always be the most important. Faced with decisions that have nothing to do with the use of coercion, how to structure a business relationship, which causes or community organizations to support, whether to go along to get along with our neighbors, freedom gives us a chance, but it doesn't help us choose. So those are Stephanie Slade's definition of comprehensive libertarians and political libertarians. And I think one of the conclusions that she comes to in the article, and if you're interested in defining what the word libertarian means, I would definitely recommend reading it. It's fantastic. But I think she comes to the conclusion at the end of her article that she's somewhere in between. And I really like Stephanie Slade's approach to a lot of these issues because she is a Catholic libertarian and I'm a Protestant libertarian. So we both share that Christian background and try to work out that relationship between libertarian philosophy and our faith. And so with Stephanie Slade, I'm somewhere in between these two issues, comprehensive libertarians and political libertarians. As a Protestant, I believe that the only source of authority is the Bible, and that is absolutely 100% the only source of authority that we as Christians should ever appeal to. But I also believe that people have to freely choose to accept it. Like, faith is ultimately a choice that cannot be forced on somebody. And as a Christian, I don't want to force my values and my beliefs on those people in society that do not share my worldview. And I think this is one of the really brilliant things about libertarian philosophy, if you're somewhere in between political libertarianism and comprehensive libertarianism, is that it solves so many of the culture war issues. If you hate Christianity and you think that it's the worst thing that ever happened to American society, but you're a libertarian, you can just choose to ignore it. And it doesn't change what we do in church on a Sunday morning. And from a Christian perspective, I love that I have the freedom to go to a because I'm a pretty traditional Christian. I love that I have the freedom to go to a traditional church, and I have very traditional beliefs about morality and spirituality and things like that. But I don't have to force it on somebody that does not choose to accept it for themselves. And so that would, I think, be an example of how comprehensive libertarian is at work in my life. But at the same time, I do believe that if you're going to come to my church has a particular stance on a lot of issues. And even though, you know, I go to a Nazarene church now because I love the community and they are incredibly involved in the community. We do a lot of service activities for the people that live there, and I love it. I am not by any means a part of the Nazarene church, although I have worked in the Wesleyan movement before, and the Nazarene movement is a part of that Wesleyan movement. So I don't accept everything that the church teaches me, but I don't try to force other people in the church to embrace my beliefs. I understand that I'm going to a church that is not going to agree with my interpretation of the Bible 100% of the time, and that's okay. And honestly, if you are an ideological Protestant, you're probably never going to find a church that's going to 100% agree with your beliefs all the time, because your understanding of Scripture can and should change as you learn more and more about it. Like, we should not make the goal of finding a church to be that you have to find a place where everyone believes exactly everything that you do. You have to find a community that fits you, and then when you're in that community, respect the tradition. Again, libertarianism solves a lot of those problems right there. We're going to talk about this in later episodes here. I'm really excited to get into those conversations. But as we start to wrap up today, I just kind of want to think about a couple of more things related to the Protestant issue here. So there is a big split in the Libertarian Party. And in libertarianism more generally. I think there are a lot of libertarians that aren't associated with the Libertarian Party. I am. And it's between the quote-unquote Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party, which is named after Ludwig von Mises, the great libertarian economist. Again, I just finished up a few days ago, and we'll be talking about this next week. The Anti-Capitalist Mentality, amazing book. Buy it right now. And then there's a difference between the Mises Caucus people, which are kind of very hardcore anti-government, pure capitalist libertarians, and then kind of the Reason wing, the Reason Magazine wing of the Libertarian Party, which is a little bit more open maybe to government control in some areas of the life of your life, and really kind of focused more on the social issues. And, you know, so my biggest recommendation, if you don't know where to come down on this issue, The Tom Woods Show is my favorite libertarian podcast of all time. I listen to it on a regular basis. Tom Woods is an incredibly principled, Mises-oriented libertarian, and I would highly recommend listening to that show as soon as I'm done. But I also listen to The Reason Roundtable every Monday, which is a production that's put out by the four editors-in-chief of chiefs of Reason Magazine, and they represent two different sides of this libertarian movement. The Mises Caucus is more of an extreme, principled, anti-government wing, as I said before, and Tom Woods absolutely represents that. And Mises people don't really care as much about the social issues. Whereas if you read Reason Magazine, they talk a lot about sexuality, and they talk about culture, and they talk about drug use, and all kinds of issues that libertarians have a perspective on. But I think temperamentally, those are kind of the two sides of the libertarian movement. It's kind of that Mises Caucus, Misesian approach to libertarianism versus the Reason kind of social issue. Okay with some sort of government approach to libertarianism. And I would think is if you're getting interested in these issues and you're starting to think this through for the first time, then you definitely need both. You should read both Reason Magazine and you should listen to the Tom Woods Show. And we're going to talk about other people that are on both sides of that libertarian divide later on. I'm personally, as I said before, more of a Mises-oriented person, very much a hardcore capitalist, very much an anti-government type of person here, even though I am a public school teacher, and I realize that that's a deep inconsistency, which we'll talk about later on, because I don't think that my bosses are ever going to listen to this show, if anyone ever listens to this show. So that'll be fun. But again, there are splits in the libertarian movement as there are splits in the Protestant movement, but both of these movements can work together. And so I think, you know, to wrap this up today, and I know I said I was going to wrap it up about 3 minutes ago, but this is my show and I am prone to go on tangents. So just as the final thing here, I think we really do need that healthy disagreement in both Protestantism and libertarianism. Maybe you disagree with my idea or with my definition of Protestantism. Maybe you are a doctrinal Protestant. Maybe you're a Reformed Calvinist. Maybe you're a classical old school Lutheran. Maybe you're a hardcore Wesleyan. I don't know where you come from, but it's okay if you disagree with my interpretation of Protestantism. Like, we can have a conversation about that. And the great thing about, you know, all of us kind of appealing to the Bible is that it allows us to see the way that different people interpret it and have a little bit more humility towards other points of view. And it's the same thing is true within libertarianism as well. Like, if the goal is just to limit the amount of power in a society and to allow people to live freer, more prosperous lives, then we can have healthy conversations and healthy disagreements about a lot of issues. And this is really, like, from a political perspective, one of the worst things about the Republican and Democrat the Republican and Democrat duopoly in Washington D.C. between, you know, the so-called conservatives and the so-called liberals is that they, both of these parties, at least if you listen to the politicians when they get on TV, they would love to completely eliminate the views of the opposing party. Like, there are so many legislative proposals. You know, we think that the liberals are the ones that are primarily responsible for this, but if you look at some of the legislative proposals that the Republicans are putting forth in states around the country, they're just as authoritarian and anti-freedom as the liberals. The Republicans are really no better than the liberals. Now, there are a lot of great Republicans that out there that talk a big game. I mean, I'm lucky enough to live in Kentucky's 4th District. I'm here from Independence, Kentucky. And so Rand Paul is my senator, and he's great, you know, probably 70, 75% of the time. My congressperson is Thomas Massey, who is, without a doubt, since the departure of Justin Amash, the most libertarian person in Congress. So there are some good people out there on both sides. But the majority of these parties have just completely fallen into this ideological box where they just want to eliminate the other side. And libertarianism allows us to take that element of power and wanting to destroy other people out of the equation and just have conversations about big issues. And so I have a ton of positions on a lot of issues that I passionately hold. But because of both my Protestant worldview, my belief that the Bible is the only source of authority and that the more I learn about it, the more it's going to change my worldview, and my belief in liberty, that people need to be able to make their own decisions and that I shouldn't force my values on somebody else. I have a lot of positions that I'm passionate about, but I am open to changing my mind based on the evidence. And I think we need more of these conversations where we respect people that have a different point of view than us. We try our hardest to understand where they're coming from. And then we try to convince other people, not by force, but by the value of our arguments. And again, Christians in particular have an extra responsibility to live this out in public, that Christians should be the first people to be open-minded and to be willing to have difficult conversations with those that do not agree with them, especially if you're a Protestant, because honestly, like any Protestant that is seriously self-reflective and have thought about, you know, their spiritual journey throughout their life will realize that, like, change is a part of that journey. And I don't believe a lot of the same things now as someone who's in my early 30s that I did when I was in my late teens. That's helpful. And a lot of the times my mind has been changed by having conversations with people or that were different than me or reading books that had a different perspective than what I was used to. And really, to close this out here, the purpose of this show is going to be to talk about big ideas related to both Protestantism and libertarianism. There is so much there that is helpful, I think, in allowing us to come to a better understanding of our place as a society or our place as human beings in society. And I think that this gives the church a big opportunity to be a witness in a constantly more and more divisive world. And again, I'm going to say this right now. If you are not a Protestant, if you're here for the libertarian stuff and you don't believe in any sort of Christian tradition or any sort of theological or spiritual movement at all, that's fine. I'm glad you're here for the libertarian stuff. Feel free to email me, criticize me, do whatever you got to do. Like, I'm here for that. These conversations are really productive, and I know that I have a lot to learn. And it's the same thing. If you're listening to this for the Protestant side of the podcast, and you're a conservative, or you're a liberal, or you're new to libertarianism, or you don't like my ideas about libertarianism, reach out to me. Like, I want to have that conversation. There's nothing that hurts having an open conversation, learning from other people, and trying to think through the big issues of life. So we're very excited to do that here on the show. Thank you so much for making it through the second full week of the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. Next week, got a very exciting show for you. I'm sure I'm going to say that at the end of every single episode, but it's true. I'm going to be comparing or looking at an example of how biblical scholars oftentimes misunderstand economics. And I'm treading on hollow ground here because one of my favorite New Testament scholars, Michael Gorman, has this brilliant commentary called Reading Revelation Responsibly on the book of Revelation. He's written several books that were incredibly influential to me, but I find some of his thoughts about economics to be deficient, to say the least. And one of the problems that I've had with the biblical studies movement is that while we have a lot of people that are in this movement that are very great at interpreting the Bible, they're not so good at understanding economics, and I think sometimes they try to draw applications from the Bible and apply them to modern economics in a way that actually does harm. And so I'm going to compare Michael Gorman's economic perspectives in Reading Revelation Responsibly with the great Ludwig von Mises's book, The Anti-Capitalist Mentality, where he tries to explain why it is that so many intellectuals don't like the idea of capitalism. And again, we're going to start out next episode with a definition of capitalism, along with a definition of apocalyptic literature, the genre in which Revelation was written. We got in a couple weeks, we're going to have a show about how I interpret the Bible and about some of, I think, the basic interpretive methods that we need to keep in mind as we read scripture. And so we're gonna dive into some of that next week. So if you're interested in the book of Revelation, especially if you think it's absolutely crazy and makes no sense and you want at least a little bit of a rational perspective on that, join up next week. If you want to hear more about Ludwig von Mises's The Anti-Capitalist Mentality, come here next week. And these two authors are going to be going head-to-head, at least in my brain. Thanks again for listening to the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Protestant Libertarian Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to reach out to me about suggestions for future shows, you can contact me at theprotestantlibertarian@gmail.com. That's theprotestantlibertarian@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.